Good afternoon. I trust that we are all feeling very good after lunch. I want to start, the name of my talk today or my lecture today is Reading Through the Invisibility of Race and 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I teach Spanish and Latin American Studies at Bates College. But I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. And I like to say that. I like to say that when I give a lecture, wherever I may be, because people don't tend to associate the Spanish language with Detroit, Michigan. The truth is, Detroit actually has not only a Mexican-American population, but there's a larger Latino population in Southwest Detroit. And there's a part of the city that deserves some representation. I'm not from the Southwest part of the city, however. I came to Spanish, I would say, in a rather curious way. In part because both of my parents paid a lot of attention to foreign language learning. My father studied several languages on his own. Though he later got a college degree, he was largely an autodidact, I would say. And my mother, being interested in the fine arts, really studied French. And I thought, what language would have the most to do with me as a person in the United States and as an African-American looking to Latin America, looking to the Global South? I thought at the time that Spanish would be far more useful. And being in high school, it was kind of fun to tell her, no, I'm not going to study French. But all that being said, I do want to situate my lecture today, acknowledging the hostile national climate in which we find ourselves. The United States is at the point of completing or coming to the end of the first African-American presidency, a presidency that has brought about the naming of two women to the United States Supreme Court, one of them being a wise Latina. She refers to herself as Justice Sotomayor, a Puerto Rican jurist, refers to herself. A presidency that has brought about marriage equality and greater visibility for transgender persons. But at the same time, it has been a presidency where we've seen a burgeoning prison industrial complex where Latino and African American men are targeted, women and children. And also it's been a time in which we've seen police action against unarmed men and women. And I want to state those things and ask you to take them into consideration as I speak today about 100 Years of Solitude. Though one may not find a direct reference between 100 Years of Solitude, which is a beautifully written novel, and the hostile climate in which we find ourselves right now, I think what we'll find that we may have in common is the difficulty of seeing and speaking about race, whether you're in 1967 in Mexico City writing a novel, or at Bowdoin College in 2016. Though we cannot know for sure, history may remember this epic as a cultural revolution, a turning point in our shared national history where heterosexual white male personhood ceased to be the norm by which all other individuals are measured. When Gabriel Garcia Marquez won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1982 for 100 Years of Solitude, he became the fourth Latin American writer to be so honored. The Nobel Committee awarded him the coveted prize, saying, quote, for his novels and short stories, in which the fantastic and the realistic are combined in a richly composed world of imagination, reflecting a continent's life and conflicts, end quote. Though the award-winning novel has inspired an enormous body of literary scholarship that viewed the mythical Macondo through myriad prisms, there has been very little focus on the presence and significance of race in the novel. The deafening silence on the racial issue has remained a constant since the novel's premiere in 1967 and persists to this day in spite of the fact that Latin America boasts a population of 150 million persons of African descent. But the reticence to acknowledge race as a social category in Latin America and the general silence around African ancestry in the region is typical of Luso-Hispanic approaches to thinking about and defining race. This is due in part to the fact that Latin Americans have defined racism as state-sponsored activity, that is, as legislation that explicitly promotes racial segregation. or racial bias. In this way, the violence of Jim Crow in the U.S. South and the militarized body politic of South African apartheid exemplify what racism looks like. And today I want us to, of course, acknowledge racism as a structural problem both in Latin America and the United States. But I want us also to think about how it articulates itself culturally so that we can sink our teeth into this novel, so that we can ask different questions. And I'm curious, if we were to adopt a racial lens, what might we see in Makondo that is otherwise invisible? We now know that Makongo is from one of the Bantu African languages, and it means banana. I wanted to share that with you, but he got there before me. I forgive him, I think. Conversations surrounding 100 years of solitude are no exception to the rule. My lecture, Reading Through the Invisibility of Race in 100 Years of Solitude, is informed by a particular set of concerns that I hope to address this morning. If 100 Years of Solitude is a novel about deciphering the destiny of the family of José Octavio Buendía and Úrsula Iguarán, as critics claim, then how might we decipher the representation of race in the novel? What lens should we use to do such work? And if we apply a racial lens to the text, what might we see that has otherwise escaped our notice? How might reading race change what we take into account? And I want to start by providing a very brief dictionary definition of race, something that I remember. I want to talk about that. Let me begin by defining race. Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary defined, quote, race, a division of humankind possessing traits that are transmissible by descent and sufficient to characterize it as a distinct human type, end quote. But recent findings have disputed scientific certainty surrounding the idea of race. Since the 1970s, modern science has proven Webster's dictionary wrong. Imagine that. Today we know that human beings are 99.9% identical genetically. I'll repeat that, 99.9% genetically identical, as Drs. Francis Collins and Craig Venter jointly announced at the White House on June 26, 2000, when the rough draft of the Human Genome Project was released. You can find that in John Harvard's journal. Scientific definitions notwithstanding, sociologist Howard Winnett defines racial formation theory accordingly, quote, from a racial formation perspective, race is understood as fluid, unstable, and decentered complex of social meanings constantly being transformed by political conflict. So while we understand that we are fighting over 0.1% of our genetic makeup, we still have to acknowledge race as a social construct. And as a sociologist, Howard Winnett comes at the problem from the standpoint of race being something that is tricky, something that's fluid, that's unstable, and that changes according to the political needs of the moment. Race, according to him, race shapes the individual psyche and it colors, quote unquote, relationships among individuals on the one hand. That feeling of discomfort when you see someone from the other group at a time which you did not expect to see him or her in a space in which you did not think they existed. Race is a social construct. I want to make that clear. It's a social construct that's articulated in the symbolic language of culture. 100 Years of Solitude is a mystery wrapped in a riddle, mocking, even taunting the reader to decipher, if she dares, the fate of a people that has already been predestined by forces greater than them. For centuries, race has been a way of thinking about the moral character, cultural sophistication, and destinies of a people that creates immutable categories based on superficial phenotypical differences. Racism, on the other hand, is a system with the purpose of transforming fictional racial destinies into tangible realities that come to be supported by empirical evidence. So today in our conversation, I want to discuss mixedness, or mestizaje is the word used in Spanish, mestizagem is a word used in Brazilian Portuguese, The concepts are important both in Brazil, Portuguese-speaking Brazil, as well as in Spanish-speaking Latin America. I am saying that race has been made invisible in Latin American criticism about 100 Years of Solitude, not because it is absent in the novel, but because it is present in a way that is so familiar that it eludes recognition. In Colonialism and Race in Luso-Hispanic Literature, Afro-Latin Americanist Jerome Branch argues that mestizaje is not merely a phenotypical descriptor for persons of African, indigenous, and European ancestry, but rather mestizaje, or mixedness, is a metaphor for social harmony. Mestizaje is a way of picturing race not in terms of difference, but rather as, quote, homogeneous, racially amalgamated collectivity, end quote. In other words, as a harmonious, multi-hued family. This multicolored family is, of course, devoid of social conflict. Latin Americans are rhetorically equipped to describe racial intermingling as a metaphor for social harmony in light of their chosen point of comparison, the United States. Latin Americans juxtapose racial intermixing with the institutionalized racial violence of the U.S. Jim Crow South, as I said before, and South Africa's now passed apartheid regime. The very visible violence of these systems of racial control stands in stark contrast with Latin American countries where conflict is explained in terms of class inequalities. Now, I do want to make clear that this doesn't mean, of course, that Latin America doesn't have a history of racialized violence towards indigenous populations, towards populations of African descent. It does. One thing that Gabriel García Márquez does in the novel is to demonstrate how his recent historical event then becomes, is fictionalized by history. And so this has taken place, for example, in Cuban history. 1912 is remembered by Black Cuban scholars as a year in which persons of African descent who were members of the first Black political party in Latin America were subjected to violence by the government. A protest of theirs was, the reaction to the protest, armed protests of theirs, was violence, and they suffered a massacre. But that massacre is not taught in Cuban textbooks, even after the revolution. So that's one example of how history is fictionalized. It's forgotten because it's uncomfortable. It's profoundly uncomfortable. So while in the United States, the notion of racial progress was very much a white Nordic model, in Latin America, it was a model of mixture, a model of co-presence, but a mixture that would make certain things disappear and privilege other things. And I want to get a little bit into that as I introduce the notion of the cosmic race. To understand mestizaje in Latin American terms, I turn to José Vasconcelos. José Vasconcelos was Mexican education minister from 1921 to 1924, so this is after the Mexican Revolution, and he published La Raza Cosmica, or The Cosmic Race, in 1925 as a defense of mestizaje, a defense of racial mixing. And he's really moving and thinking in opposition to 19th century social Darwinist theories. And those theories characterize that racial mixing would bring about degradation. So he's looking out at Latin America as other white Latin Americans had done before, largely male Latin Americans had done, and say, what do we do about the question of our racial diversity? How do we view it? How do we see it? And Vasconcelos is, in a short way of putting it briefly, is that essentially this will make us stronger. Our racial intermingling will bring about a fifth race that will be greater than the others. There's two things that I want to point to today. Vasconcelos' theory of the cosmic race put forth two ideas that are important for my lecture today. Number one, that racial intermixing did not lead to cultural and intellectual ruin, but that it would aid Latin America to achieve what other mestizo cultures such as Egypt, Greece, and Rome had accomplished. Secondly, to ensure the cultural progression of the cosmic race, Vasconcelos argued for what Jerome Branch calls, quote, an aesthetic eugenics, end quote, so that Greco-Roman principles of beauty, emotion, and refined taste would predominate in the development of the new cosmic race. In this way, Vasconcelos mused that more advanced human beings would absorb less sophisticated, even backward cultural groups. And so what's interesting, what Vasconcelos does, he goes into the Mexican countryside And he takes classics, European classics, and I want to say that because they're African classics as well. But he takes European classics, and they're in Spanish, and he passes them out to the indigenous people. And he begins a process, a project of assimilation. But when he thinks about this mixture of indigenous, African, and European, he doesn't abandon the notion that European cultural values rooted in Greece and Rome, as he understood it, would lead the way to the refining of Latin American culture. He doesn't abandon that notion. And worse still, Vasconcelos reasoned that the black race would disappear within a few decades of the mestizaje process that it would willingly take part in, and that indigenous persons would promptly become modern and civilized. Some scholars call this the quantum leap. Okay? So it's really important because this is in line with the Latin American notion, and I work largely in the Hispanophone Caribbean, the notion of mejorar la raza. Don't you marry him. He's too dark. Your babies are going to have bad hair. You have to improve the race. And we laugh about it. I laugh about it a lot because I think it's ridiculous. But at the same time, my own positionality asked me to ask, where is that present? Where could that be present? Is that sneaking there? Where is that present in my own way of thinking and moving? I think the most effective thing we can do with a literary text like this is to ask, what didn't I see and why didn't I see it? What does it tell me about the racial ideology that I might be wedded to unknowingly? So I want to talk about the racial motifs in the novel before we take a look at the next image. The treatment of race in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude can be represented in three motifs. Race as a deterministic marker of human identity, that is, as a sign of inescapable destiny, the inescapable destiny of a people. Race as cultural and biological mixture, commonly celebrated as mestizaje. And finally, overseas exotica as a cultural euphemism for Afro-Latin American culture. I'm thinking particularly when he makes a reference to Madagascar. I'm going to speak briefly on Madagascar. I haven't found much on it in the novel. In fact, I'm not sure there's any research on it at all. But I want to speak about it very, very briefly. Today, I seek to expound upon these motifs by doing a close reading of two passages from Garcia Marquez's novel. 100 Years of Solitude broke with the theory of cosmic race, in my view, by returning to the reader to a pre-Vasconcelos moment when racial intermingling was an unambiguous statement of impurity. And by this, I just want to reference that in 15th century Spain, the first articulation of racial difference comes with the language of blood impurity. And as Christians begin to gain power, they look at Jewish persons and Africans and Arabs who are Muslim, who are called the Moors or los Moros, as being having impure blood. So the notion of limpieza de sangre, or purity of blood, enters into the discourse. And it has a very political function for keeping Jewish persons and Muslims, some which were black African and some which were Arab, out of political power. People who had been, who had exercised political power. And this brings to the point, this is before Christopher Columbus's voyage to what we now call the Americas. And this is before King Ferdinand and his wife Isabel, or Isabella in English, financed his journeys to what became, eventually became the conquest of what we now call Latin America. And so I mention all of that because that's the backdrop. That whole notion of is your blood pure was initially tied to religious discourse and religious categories. But back to the novel. When Amaranta resists the sexual advances of her nephew Aureliano Jose, she warns him, quote, any children will be born with a tail of a pig, end quote. Mestizaje is destiny in this novel, but it's not the destiny that Vasconcelos imagined and hoped for. It's degradation. 100 Years of Solitude leaves no doubt about the cultural heritage and racial lineage of the Buendia family. The marriage between Úrsula Iguarán and José Arcadio Buendia, the matriarch and patriarch, is a classic representation of how prominent Latin American families constituted themselves racially. The matriarch, Úrsula Iguarán's great-grandfather, was an Aragonese, or from Aragon, and José Arcadio Buendia is described as a Creole tobacco farmer. Though in the United States the term Creole refers to racial mixture, and it's largely associated with Louisiana, In Spanish America, Ibis speaks a native-born person, generally of European ancestry. Aragon's claim to fame in the history of Spanish Empire are without dispute, because Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon's marriage in 1469, also before Columbus's voyages, produced a political union that spearheaded European settlement of the Western Hemisphere for more than a century. The Buendía family is what Latin Americans have often referred to as a buena familia, good family. That is a prosperous Creole family thought to be unblemished by mestizo, Afro-Latin American, or indigenous lineage. They are the, quote, New World equivalent of the old Christians on the Iberian Peninsula. So at the end of the 15th century and into the early 16th century, in order to claim one's purity, one would claim that they were a viejo cristiano. I'm an old Christian. I'm a Christian before the Jews, Jewish persons, and the Muslims were made to convert. It was a way of saying that my blood is pure, has always been pure. García Márquez's choice of Aragon as the ancestral home of Úrsula Iguarán's great-grandfather is, as I have tried to show, of great symbolic significance. With this in mind, I analyze 100 Years of Solitude as a story about a white Latin American family's fall from grace into a multitude of vices, the degradation and destruction of the race being chief among their transgressions. Úrsula, the matriarchal figure that García Márquez constructs as the sole voice of reason, is certainly not silent on that matter. Úrsula described the vices of the Buendía men as, quote, the talk of war, fighting cocks, bad women, and wild undertakings, end quote. Should be careful with all of those. I will give first consideration to the bad women or mala mujer stereotype. The mala mujer stereotype is illustrative of a tendency for euphemism and misnomers in the Hispanophone Caribbean and Latin America. By evoking the bad woman stereotype, Úrsula is able to allude to many forms of marginality and sexual impropriety through a distinctly racist cultural lens without ever uttering the word negra, or black woman. And I'll talk briefly just about that word negra. Some years ago, I was teaching a graduate course at the University of Kansas, and I was talking to a class of some US persons and many Latin Americans. And we had a discussion about the word negro, negra. And in the process, one of the things that really came to light is that that word black, black woman, black man, but black in Spanish, is of course refers to the color, black as it does in English, refers to the race, but it could also refer to the N-word. It could also refer to something else. And it's a highly, I think as a native speaker of English, I think even more so than the word in English, it's a very ambivalent word, fundamentally ambivalent word. García Márquez's omniscient narrator sums up Úrsula's attitude regarding the vices of José Arcadio II and Aureliano II thus, quote, it was as if the defects of the family and none of the virtues had been concentrated in both. Then she, Úrsula, decided that no one again would be called Aureliano or José Arcadio, end quote. She, of course, is not successful, and they keep renaming people with the same names, and people continue to make the same mistakes, something that's just profoundly human. On another occasion, Úrsula chided her great-grandson, Aureliano II, for his illicit relationship with a mulatto woman by the name of Petra Cotes. Petra Cotes. And I want to provide you with an image. Now, this is a Cuban image here. La Mulata de Rumbo, it was 1881. It's published in a book by a Spanish painter, a very talented Spanish painter, called Victor Landaluce. And this is influenced by the color writing, artistic movement in the 19th century. And this is not uncommon in Latin America. I'm not sure how much call and response we want to do right now, but does anyone want to shout out something that stands out to them in this image? Is anyone feeling that bold today? Or should I be didactic? Okay, I'll be didactic here then. Okay, so the first thing I want to point out here is that the image, in the image, she is looking away. She's not looking straight forwardly at what would be the camera or be the center point. She's holding what seems to be an abanico in her hand or a fan. She has her hands on her hips, and her hips are slightly pushed up into the air. And she's showing her neck and a bit of cleavage. Her arms are also exposed. Now, by today's standard, she's very elegant, but that would have been somewhat risque. And I'm going to juxtapose this with another image so that you kind of get the point. And so the painting is called, translating this to me is a bit difficult, but it would be The Mulatto Woman on the Street. That's how I would translate it. Rumbo refers to one's direction, one's path. De rumbo. You know, we say someone is sin rumbo, it means that she's lost or he's lost. And she's almost smiling, so she looks a bit coqueta. She's a little bit flirtatious. And so this is one of the prominent images of the mulata. Another thing I will draw your attention to is her hair. And this is very important in the Spanish-speaking Caribbean in particular, which is a region of high African ancestry. And so the curl of one's hair, the lay of one's hair, whether the hair is very straight, whether it is cabello ondulado or wavy hair, is thought to speak to one's ancestry, even though they're Africans with hair like that. But they're thought to speak to one's European ancestors, and sometimes have been cited as a claim of fame. And so I want to point to La Mulata de Rumbo as I continue, and I want to provide you with an image that you might be able to use to imagine Petra Cortez. So she's a woman of African descent, but she's thought to be of lighter skin and to have perhaps straighter hair. So let's continue to explore this. On another occasion, Ursula chided her great-grandson. She shouted, quote, "That woman has been your ruination. She's got you so bewitched that one of these days I'm going to see you twisting around with colic and with the toad in your belly," end quote. Ursula's use of animalistic imagery not only characterized the supposed contamination of her family's lineage, but also insinuates that Latin American women of African descent possess a third sense, an ability to access African ritual powers that Catholic societies had misnamed witchcraft. Ursula's concern is that the Buena Familia's lineage and social reputation, and she racializes Petra Cortez without saying racially explicit discourse, without using racially explicit discourse. So that's one of the most important things, to be able to use a put down, but to maintain one's manner and to say nothing that can be really traced back to any known form of racism, any recognizable form of racism. So I want to talk now about Petra Cortez. This is one of the passages that I'm going to read word for word. I don't have the passage on the screen. When people do that, I get lost, so I thought I would not do that. So I'll just read them. It's a passage you've surely have read before. Quote, "Her name was Petra Cortez. She had arrived in Macondo in the middle of the war with a chance husband who lived off the raffles. When the man died, she kept up the business. She was a clean young mulatto woman with yellow almond-shaped eyes that gave her face the ferocity of a panther. But she had a generous heart and a magnificent vocation for love. It was as if the defects of the family and none of the virtues had been concentrated in both." And now, with reference to the animals her lover, I want to read this. Quote, "His mares would bear triplets. His hens laid twice a day, and his hog fattened with such speed that no one could explain such disorderly fecundity except to the use of black magic. The more he opened champagne to soak his friends, the more wildly his animals gave birth, and the more he was convinced that his lucky star was not a matter of his conduct, but the influence of Petra Cortez, his concubine, whose love had the virtue of exasperating nature," end quote. So I want to open up that passage just a little bit there. She's described as a clean young woman. Let's talk first about her and her appearance, and then I have something to say about her lover. Garcia Marquez's description of Petra as a clean young mulatto woman grants her an air of attractiveness that is close enough to European standards of beauty that it does not offend Hispanic sensibilities. On the other hand, Petra has, quote, "yellow almond-shaped eyes that gave her the ferocity of a panther," end quote. Petra's relatively light brown skin, commonly referred to as canela or cinnamon color, makes her more desirable to white Hispanic men, but does not enable her to escape the animalistic characteristics ascribed to the Afro-Latina female sexuality. Though mulatto women were afforded a higher place with the Latin American pigmentocracies than black women, a political order that affords socioeconomic privilege based on the relative lightness of the skin. So with pigmentocracy, I'm talking about a political order based on the relative lightness of the skin. So the lighter someone got, the more privilege they would be afforded. So instead of thinking of white and black in terms of an absolute dichotomy or a binary, you have to think of degrees of whiteness. How can one become whiter and whiter? So it's in many ways, I would say, a perverse way of identifying with the oppressor. On the other hand, Petra has these eyes. Though mulatto women were afforded a higher place in Latin American pigmentocracies, the racial epithet mulatto has its origins in deterministic ideas about animal breeding. The word mulatto is derived from the word mule and is reminiscent of white American debates concerning whether or not black persons could be deemed members of the same species as whites. So the word becomes, and this is what I mean by the perverse, that the word becomes a way of complimenting someone. No, you're not a black woman, you're not a negra, you're a mulata, you know, but at the same time, it by using that word, you're complimenting someone. Someone may smile, may feel good. I've had people say things like that when I travel throughout Latin America. And if you try to tell them, no, I'm a black person, they look at you like something's wrong with you, because they are living in a different universe. They have a different cultural, the symbolic language of race is different in their culture. And so racial meaning shifts as your body moves, if you're a person of African descent, as your body moves throughout the world. One critic considers Petra Cortes the most memorable mulatto character in the novel. Petra is a lifelong concubine to Aureliano II, who married Fernanda, a European-descended woman closely resembling a white matriarch from the U.S. South. And I want to show you an image of, we don't have an image of her, of Fernanda, but what I was able to find are some images by a Cuban, because my area of research is Cuba. The book I'm working on is about black Cuban writers in the colonial period, race, religion, and ritual. And so I constantly have Cuba on the mind, and Cuba's known for these beautiful representations of cityscapes, and in this case, of a white Cuban woman. And you can't see it at the bottom there, but if you were able to look down, it says Isla de Cuba, and then it says Señora de La Habana. She's a mistress of Havana, perhaps. And Teodoro Guerrero, I'm crediting Teodoro Guerrero for this. So Las Criollas, once again, that word Creole. And what we can see if we were to compare the two, we have La Mulata de Rumbo, and then we have La Señora. Notice that one of them is seated, the other is standing. One of them has her hand on her hips, and her hips are kind of jutting out or pushing out, and the other does not. One has a contemplative pose. She looks thoughtful. Her fan is, I think that's an abanico. She has it in her lap. And the other is kind of looking out, probably towards someone of the opposite sex. One is on the street, and one is domesticated and quiet and non-threatening. And so with the juxtaposition of these two images, I would propose that we're provided with an idea of the racial histories of the Hispanophone Caribbean. So 100 Years of Solitude, yes, is a quintessentially Latin American novel. It's the Quixote of Latin America, but it's a Caribbean novel. In some ways, it's a Caribbean novel with very strong Afro-Caribbean components. And so Garcia Marquez, for all of his brilliance, his representation of women of African descent is not innovative. Unfortunately, it falls on very damaging stereotypes. So I want to take this to continue here, and as I move towards the end, I want to speak about the male characters in the novel, particularly the Los 17 Hijos, right? The 17 sons. And that has this, you know, has this another connotation, right? Let me see if I can show you one other thing, though, before I think I promised you the queen. Okay. This is the Queen of Madagascar, who I'm glad they have the dates. You can see when she lived. And if you look at the Queen of Madagascar appears in the novel, and she appears in the novel at least twice. And I think, as I remember, one of the occasions in which she's referenced is she's juxtaposed with Petra Kotes. This whole notion of dressing as the Queen of Madagascar appears in the novel. But perhaps because of the subgenre of magical realism, there's really no explanation of who she was. Now, she was the ruler of Madagascar, came to power in 1828. She was a literate ruler. She was someone who actually didn't consider written language the exclusive domain of white European diplomats. She actually thought it was of use, or missionaries. She thought it was of use to herself, so she would write letters in communication with them. She was aware of modern warfare, knew modern warfare, and she had a group of scribes that worked with her, part of her royal court. She wasn't anti-modern, but she maintained a reverence for African ancestors. Now, I wanted to mention her because I think that, and show you an image of her, because my reading of the novel is that she appears in kind of opportune moments to reinforce this notion of blackness as something that's exotic, that is present, but kind of uncomfortably so. And I think that's tied to Vasconcelos' notion of the cosmic race, where blackness is supposed to disappear. So one of the most challenging things to introduce in a Spanish language classroom, which is the only classroom I've ever taught in, is blackness or Africanity. Not necessarily because students don't want to learn, but because they're so profoundly unfamiliar with this presence to begin with. And this is also true for Latin American students. And so, but you see the caption, serial killer monarch. She was called the Mad Queen because she resisted the French, sometimes successfully, routed the French in the 1820s, the Madagascans did. And so what I want to suggest here is that the representation of the Queen of Madagascar, I'm going to try to pronounce her name, I'm going to say it in Spanish, the Rana Balona, would also allows the omniscient narrator to locate Afro-Colombians as belonging in the national space, but uncomfortably so. So they're still somewhat exotic, particularly when we see the way the fecundity of Petra Cortes, but also at the same time, it allows the caption here castigates her or punishes her for her resistance. So she becomes a crazy woman, as would a witch perhaps in medieval Europe, because she's resisting male authority, or she seeks to reshape it. Back to Fernanda briefly, or to Petra Cortes briefly. Petra Cortes is a character that Garcia Marquez condemns to the trope of hypersexuality. Petra has what can only be explained as a magical influence on the fertility of her lover's livestock, when his livestock multiply in ways that are inexplicable within the rubric of the biological sciences. Aureliano II credits the sexual powers of his mistress, but when he fell into financial ruin, he also thinks Petra's waning sexuality or waning sexual exuberance is to blame. In this way, the fact that she is a mulatto woman does not allow Petra Cortes to escape the dictum that the black female was assigned value in slave societies according to their perceived ability to increase their owner's livestock, or the owner's stock, excuse me. So in terms of black women existing to reproduce, Petra Cortes, in other words, as a mulatto woman, does not escape blackness. I want to take a moment now to begin to speak about the mulatto sons, and thinking about the presence of the mulatto sons as illegitimate sons, as the fruit of warfare, in a sense. And I'm going to quote directly from the text, quote, "Then Colonel Aureliano Buendia took down the bar and saw at the door 17 men of the most varied appearance of all types and colors, but all of the solitary air that would have been enough to identify them anywhere on earth. They were his sons. Without any previous engagement, without knowing each other, they had arrived from the most distant corners of the coast, captivated by the talk of jubilee. They all bore with pride the name Aureliano and the last name of their mothers. The 3 days that they stayed in the house, to the satisfaction of Úrsula and the scandal of Fernanda, were like a state of war. Amaranta searched among old papers for the ledger where Úrsula had written down the names and birth and baptism dates of all of them. And beside the space of each one, she added his present address, end quote. The 17 sons of Coronel Arellano Buendía returned, figuratively speaking, to their father's house in search of legitimacy, in search of their birthright, something their father's womanizing had denied them. Colonel Arellano is akin to a Spanish conquistador because he indiscriminately spreads his seed among the native women and feels neither responsibility nor compunction for having done so. The fact that he is not only absent but also completely ignorant that his mulatto and mestizo sons even exist is yet another hallmark of Spanish conquistador masculinity in the colonial period. The near magical appearance of his sons in Macondo functions as a return of sorts to a fictive place of origins, which is also their father's birthplace. But Macondo belongs to them in myth alone, because the mulatto sons only bear his first name and they carry 17 different surnames from 17 different nameless women of color. So I want to talk very briefly about Aureliano Triste, who is the most important, I would say, African-descended male character in the novel. What's interesting is that he does reflect history of the Caribbean colonial period, which, of course, Aracataca or Macondo forms a part of, and that he's a tradesman, and he's the one who introduces the railroad to Macondo in the novel. I thought it was very interesting as these characters are not characterized for their sexuality. Aureliano Amador, another one of them, is a friend to the indigenous. And initially, he escapes the massacre of the sons of the colonel because he's living among the indigenous. But he returns, and he's marked like everyone else with the cross of the Ash Wednesday. And he is later killed, and he's not remembered. And so that's one of the reasons why that he receives no protection from the family. But there's another way of reading this that is a bit more ominous, and that's to think of these men of African descent being disappeared in the novel, being destroyed, they're marked for destruction. So there's, if you think about a culture of an aesthetics that is influenced by eugenics, you can read this from another place and ask, why are they destroyed? Why are they killed off, so to speak? Garcia Marquez alludes to the Afro-Caribbeanness of the colonel's 17 sons by noting that they had arrived from the most distinct corners of the coast. Colombian coastal cities, like Cartagena, known in colonial times as Cartagena de las Indias, have boasted an African cultural presence since the colonial era due to the devastating effects of the transatlantic slave trade. From 1701 to 1810, slave merchants transported nearly 500,000 African persons to the Spanish Caribbean. Most of them were sent to Cuba, but not all of them. As a mark of their illegitimacy, the narrator is silent about the precise ancestry of the mothers of the colonel's mulatto sons. We can infer, however, that these 17 anonymous women are the descendants of Africans transported to Colombia during the aforesaid historical period. Anonymity doesn't protect their identity, nor does it restore them any sense of honor that has been lost, but rather, anonymity reaffirms their position within Latin American racial hierarchies. They are invisible by virtue of their relative insignificance. 100 Years of Solitude is a novel that reproduces the Latin American racial order in all its aspects. We have the timid and submissive indigenous characters. And if you remember towards the beginning of that novel, Úrsula and Jose Arcadio, the matriarch and the patriarch, are living among them with there being no problem, no conflict. We have the defilement of white European lineage due to racial intermingling with La Mala Mujer. And we have the sensuous mulatto woman who's eager and sexually available to white men. And in addition to that, we have the men of African descent designated, many of them designated as mulattos, that are disappeared. The novel discusses race as erotic pleasure, quaint Indian domestic serpents, and foreign exotica. In conclusion, 100 Years of Solitude discusses race in a way that renders racial conflict virtually invisible in spite of its presence. Thank you.
Maybe my question is because I'm so defended around the issues of race. I think a lot of it is probably unconscious, but when you talk about all the, you know, the 17 Aurelianos who are children of black women, it seems to me that why would the black women be so attractive to Aureliano if they didn't have some sort of power?
What I'm seeking to do with that particular critique is not to suggest that they were powerless themselves. There's a long history of African descended women as resistors in the United States. Of course, there's Harriet Tubman, and in Jamaica, there's Nanny. It's not a matter of them being, who was a Maroon? Nanny was a Maroon in Jamaica. It's not a matter of them being powerless, but what I'm seeking to do is to demonstrate that the novel is constructed, it's very Eurocentric, but it's constructs its viewpoint in a way that kind of hides, I think, the racial stereotypes. And so surely they had some allure, and you would have to look also at context. The specific local context is really important. There's some work that's been done in the Caribbean early period where you have women of African descent who were shopkeepers, who owned property, who were in position to, who were living their lives with success, who were not owned by anyone. And they would sometimes, according to this research, they would form liaisons with poor European men who didn't have anything and were looking to build lives. And so it's an incredibly complex matter. I would suggest, if you're looking for further reading, I don't know if you want me to suggest, but if you are, Hortense Spiller's piece, Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, it's a very fine theoretical piece, and she uses that title, I think, to give you a kind of giggle, but it's coming from an African-American vernacular tradition. And what she talks about there is a very difficult question of the sexuality of black women, because so many different labels have been imposed on them. So how does one then claim that label and say, yes, I am such and such, and I'm going to use my power thus? To what extent is one being victimized? And as a cisgender black man, it's kind of hard for me to go too far in exploring that. But what I hoped to do, and I hope I was successful at doing this, is to demonstrate that the novel is constructing those women in a way that makes them either invisible because they were a stop along the way for the colonel, or that glorifies them in a way that puts them in an uncomfortable juxtaposition with white women. So he's reproducing the slave plantation. I should probably say this as well. He's reproducing the slave plantation. So the woman of European descent plays the role where she is quietly seated. That's Fernanda's role. She's quietly seated. She offends no one. It's not until the end of the novel that she actually confronts him by his infidelity. In fact, at one point in the novel, she just brings his clothes to the house. Oh, he's at his mistress's house. I'll bring him his clothes. And so if we think in terms of feminism, and I'll say I'm pro-feminist. I am a man, once again. So I want to keep my own subject position in mind. But if we think in terms of feminism, then there's something there both women, whether they're of European or African descent, in terms of how do they construct their relationship to white male patriarchy, heterosexual patriarchy. What type of questions should be asked? What possibilities for alliances are there? What conversations need to take place before such alliances can be articulated, if they are desired?
I find the book in dealing with race is very cosmopolitan. I mean, they're talking about people from all over the world within this small town. And to me, it seems the people that are kind of set apart, aside, are the indigenous people. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. I can say a little something about that. It's difficult to say a lot about the indigenous people. In my classes at Bates, when I teach Survey of Latin American Literature, I actually begin with indigenous responses to Spanish encroachment. So I began with some of the 16th century Mexican writings. There's a book called Vision of the Vanquished, which is available in English, if anyone wants to check that out. I know we have a serious literati here in the room. And that that really can provide an idea of how Mexica or ancient Mexicans, dispossessed of their lands and of their religions, not entirely of their religions though, then begin to negotiate that process. That text in and of itself, produced by a Mexican scholar in the mid-20th century, I think is one of the best things that you could use to read this novel. And I say that because I'm not familiar with indigenous populations in Colombia. And it's useful because their lament about the loss of power in this novel is invisible. It's not invisible everywhere. There is an Indianist tradition by white Latin American men and women that decries the abuse of Latin Americans who are indigenous in the 19th century. That tradition does exist. And the Mexican Revolution itself, the indigenous trend of the Mexican Revolution, which follows that work done in the 19th century in novels like Birds Without a Nest, the Peruvian novel by a white Peruvian woman, Mato de Turner, the indigenous emphasis of the Mexican Revolution creates those beautiful murals, Orozco, Diego Rivera, for example. But in the novel, I would have to say in 100 Years of Solitude that you have Visitacion, who is a domestic servant, and she is voiceless. I mean, she's voiceless. What's interesting, there's a moment where some of the Buendia children know the native language, and they speak that language, and they're less comfortable with Spanish. And that's perhaps could be read as a transcultural moment, because those sorts of things happen when people from different cultures live in and when there's co-presence. But I think they're marginalized, I think, even more than Afro-Latin Americans.
I have a slightly different take, but I'm interested in what you think about.
Okay.
In the very beginning of this novel, the gypsies are revered, I think. They bring the ice. They bring the carpets, the magic carpets mm-hmm. people can fly around on. They bring a lot of things, including great friendship and adventures. Mm-hmm. And so, and Petra, as a character for me, was hugely appealing and alluring. And at the very end of the book, there's a fantastic lovemaking scene, and of course it's incest, and the baby does have a pig's tail mm-hmm. and dies and so forth. But the whole novel is full of these ups and downs and fecundity and then despair and you know, so to me it seems a little more complex than to say that the black women, for example, of the Orianos are invisible. They are, but their sons are certainly not. And I just think that, to me, it's a new. There's a lot of more nuance in this thing than maybe you're giving us.
I definitely acknowledge the nuance. Like I said in the lecture, Petra Cortes is the most developed African descended character in the novel. She is an important character. I didn't get a chance to say this in the lecture, but she actually brings Fernanda, she supports Fernanda after Fernanda's husband has passed on. And so that also sounds very Southern to me in the U.S. sense of the word, right? I think one of the things that is so painful about the racial saga is that though we know it was invented by man or by humankind, it's hard to undo. And I think that sometimes we don't want to see it when it's present. It's not that Fernanda was a bad person. I don't think that Garcia Marquez meant to suggest that she was a bad person. She's very complex. They both accept different roles in the life of that man. She's the other woman, as Nina Simone would say. She seems to be happy with that role. Some men are happy with that role. But she is very different, I would say, than the wives. Not the wives, because they aren't wives, but the mothers of the other Arellanos, because they are invisible.
Hi. I wanted to ask about Melquiades. He's not African, but he's a gypsy. As I was reading, I assumed that he was very dark-skinned. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that he's in his room, and he's spinning the whole history of the world and writing it as they're living
in
it.
Sanskrit.
So he actually has a great deal of power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm remembering that there weren't that many people that respected him. I mean, it was really just the one, you know, the patriarch mm-hmm. who was involved with him. But I was wondering what your take on his role in the whole culture of the.
I like the way the character's written. You know, I smile when I read Melquiades. I mean, this is one of the other presentations. I think Ilan spoke about the presence of the Bible. I think it was Ilan, but it's a biblical name. So I like his character. I thought his character was fun, and the whole notion that there's kind of a mastermind behind the history. But his character is I read his character as well, as much as I enjoyed it, as a version of Spanish-American Orientalism. The Roma are nomadic people, as I understand it, and in Europe they don't necessarily have a place. So they're kind of stateless actors. And so he pops up one place, he pops up another place, he's dead. When you think he's dead, and he comes back, he's magical, right? Kind of like we'd all like to be. And I think that in a lot of ways he's a trope for determinism, because he's writing their story and they have no power. They don't have the human agency over their own story that they would like to believe they have. And that is tied back to race, because race, the whole notion of race is that this has all been determined for you. This is your destiny in the world. You know, that Aristotelian distinction between those with brains and those with brawn. Though the notion of race that we now have didn't exist in Aristotle's time, I should say. But I think it's a beautiful character. I really like Melquiades, but I don't think that... I think his character has a particular function in the novel. I think it's to speak to determinism.
Would you comment on the character who's not invisible, Negromante?
Oh, I almost didn't dare touch Negromante. I said, I don't know if I have time for Negromante. And the reason why I say this, and I'm smiling, because the book that I'm working on is taking me some time. So if you believe in God, please pray for me. But if you don't, meditate, do something. But what's complicated, I'm looking at these two 19th century African descended poets who really use Catholicism and Romanticism and Neoclassicism as a way of talking about African spirituality, alluding to it without saying it, affirming and negating meaning at the same time. And African-derived spirituality in and of itself is such a broad topic and difficult topic to deal with that it's taken me for a while. When I saw Negromante, I saw someone that reminded me of Petra Cortes in the sense that she also for a time becomes a mistress. But she understands the value that's been assigned her in that society. And so she does what? She charges for it. She says, well, okay, this is the value you've assigned me. I'm going to make some money off of this. And, you know, and this, of course, he really wants someone else. I think he really wants his auntie, I believe it is. And Amaranta Ursula, I think it is who he really wanted. But she plays the role for a time. What's so complex about her character, and I think the reason why I laughed, is because the notion of black magic or reference to African ritual powers is more pronounced with her character. And she's doing some markings. She makes a series of markings, I believe behind the door, every time she's dealing with him. And I thought, I said, this sounds like what has been called sand divination. I said, this sounds something like what exists in Yoruba-based or Yoruban-based traditions that have a Nigerian antecedent in Cuba. It sounded like Ifa to me. I thought, could that be a reference? And I said, I better go back and look at Ifa again. I said, I don't have time to do that. But she, that character, so once again, so we're uncomfortable with race. I understand I'm uncomfortable with it a lot of times too. We're uncomfortable with many gender categories. But people find their ways in the world, their way in the world. And then Negromante, with Negromante, I have this impression that she had access to a certain kind of power that she could call upon when she needed it. So I don't think she is entirely a victim, as I don't think Petra is entirely a victim either.
Could you, over here, sorry.
I'm sorry. I feel like I have bad eyesight all of a sudden.
In Charles's introductory remarks for you, he referenced, again, Faulkner, Absalom. And in that book, the blood and the purity of one's blood is pretty critical. Mm. And somewhat the same in this book. I mean, Ursula warning Remedios, stay away from your 17 cousins because of their blood. Now, there was some relationship there. But is blood also a euphemism for race? to some degree, or how would you react to the role of blood, particularly given your 99.9% study as well?
Yeah. It can mean a lot of things. It can mean a lot of things. Blood is a way of talking about relation euphemistically. She's my blood, he's my blood. We have no blood relation. I do think, though, because the novel is, when we say it's the Quixote of Latin America, we want to say that it's a classic, that it tells the story of Latin America, that the particular is universal, right? Macondo is supposed to be out of the middle, in the middle of nowhere. We know it hasn't been disconnected from the world entirely. But it is a novel that seeks to tell the story of Latin America. It doesn't necessarily do a bad job of that. And the process of doing that establishes Aragon. This is the kingdom that Ferdinand came from, Fernando, right? As origin. So if Aragon is origin, then it behooves us at least to engage the political, religious, and racial histories of Spain in order to understand the novel. So I would then argue, it follows for me, that blood is largely a way of speaking about race, particularly when Ursula, the voice of reason, is using it. Because remember, the men go mad. The women don't go mad. The men go mad. The women don't go mad. So Ursula is the voice of reason. I do think she's telling them, you know, be careful. Be careful. You need to improve the race.
Just to follow up on that question, you tend to see connections, perhaps, that don't exist or that may exist, but the connection between Marques and Faulkner, I mean, he went to Oxford on a kind of pilgrimage. And one of the things that during your discussion here that struck me was the connection between Colonel Arellano Buendía and Colonel Sutpin. They're both colonels, they're both warriors, and they both have children that are, you know, of mixed race.
I'm sorry, you said Arellano Buendía and whom else?
And Thomas Sutpin, who's in the Absalom Absalom.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't make that connection.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is that, you know, the 17 Arellanos are killed, mm-hmm. just as Thomas Sutpin's mixed race. Mm-hmm. And so I'm mm-hmm. wondering if that's really subtle in 100 Years of Solitude, but not so subtle in Absalom Absalom. And does it play into this, I don't know if stereotype is the right word, but this idea that, you know, if you're a black male, you are in danger of not living out your life. And is that something that perhaps is a very subtle text here in 100 Years of Solitude, or perhaps you could comment on that?
I appreciate your question. It's a very brave question. I don't want to speak on Absalom, but outside my bailiwick, but with regard to los hijos ilegítimos, or the illegitimate sons of the colonel, upon closer reading of the novel, and remember this, you know, Latin American criticism has not been reading this novel through the lens of race, and that's why I asked the question from the beginning, if we read it through the lens of race, what might we see? And that's not to say that every interaction in the novel is racially motivated or is based on race. But I do think the disappearance of these sons being disappeared, what I'm doing is I'm using the language Latin American dictatorships. I say, oh, these people, you know, los desaparecidos, you know, they're not here anymore. And that's something that was done to people regardless of race. That was a political project that was based on political orientation and people who wanted to challenge dictatorships, such as in a place like Argentina. So I use that language to say that the omniscient narrator it's not realism, so he's not explaining to us that these people were disappeared because of their race, but they're marked. They're marked, and the priest marks them, and it's an indelible mark. It's a mark that doesn't go away. And so I think of, I as a Caribbeanist, Latin Americanist, I think of Juan Bosch, his story, the La Mancha Indeleble, you know, the mark that cannot be removed, in reference when he's talking about the 1937 Trujillo massacre of Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent. And he talks about that mark that can't be removed. And in that case, it was blackness and it was ethnicity. It was the inability to be or refusal by the nation to move these people in, to embrace these people. So I think anytime characters are disappeared in that way, you have to ask questions about what might be the covert political message. Once again, I don't think that Garcia Marquez is saying that's what should happen. It's not always easy to establish authorial intent. And I'm less interested in that and more interested in what do we create when we're not thinking, when we're feeling. What structures of feeling do we participate in? That's what I'm more interested in. So I do think that it's very tied to this notion of the vulnerability of men of African descent, whether you're talking about the United States, my hometown, Detroit, or you're talking about Colombia or Brazil.
What do we think Marquez thought about his own racial identity?
I don't know how he identified, and that might be a question for Ilan, if Ilan wants to answer that when we get to the panel phase. But the nature of his writing suggests to me that he may have identified with the mestizo identity. Mestizaje is a leitmotif in his work. So, but and he's not described. What's interesting to me too, as a literary scholar, is that he's not described as a mestizo Latin American writer. He's just a Latin American writer. And so, in my experience, and I'm not sure if my colleagues would agree with this, it seems that he's assigned a. Because his stature is so important for Latin America, I mean, 25 million copies of a novel. That's like Michael Jackson's Thriller in the 1980s. I mean, that's phenomenal, a novel, you know? I would say that he's almost assigned, I think his mestizaje is just not mentioned. It's like it's made invisible. Because Vargas Llosa, Carlos Fuente, Jorge Luis Borges, these are white Latin American men. And they'll be white if they come to the United States. They have a little accent, so, you know, extranjero, but still, you know? You couldn't deny the phenotypical whiteness. Garcia Marquez, you can deny it. You can question it. And so I would assume that perhaps mestizo, but I'm not sure how he identified. That's the best I could do. Thank you so much for engaging an important question today.